It's been 2+ weeks since Election Day. The swearing-in is still to come, and most of the swearing-at is over. President-elect Barack Obama, John McCain, and their former running mates are likely looking forward to a hearty Thanksgiving, as is NPR special correspondent Susan Stamberg. But her holiday plans are haunted by the ghosts of politics past.
Maybe like me, you will be doing your holiday marketing this weekend. There are always raw cranberries on the top of my shopping list because it is time to make Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish.
I say it ain't so, Joe.
My name is Susan.
There you go again, pointing backwards.
But
again.
Governor Palin, it's an NPR tradition. The annual recitation of my late mother-in-law Marjorie Stamberg's recipe for cranberry relish. The recipe that sounds terrible and tastes terrific.
This is dangerous. It isn't just naive. It's dangerous.
Actually, it's quite benign and simple. You ready for the list of ingredients? The recipe calls for 2 cups of raw cranberries and then just a few more things.
This orgy of spending?
Not a bit. It's a very short list. In addition to the cranberries, you buy 1 small onion. And be careful about the onion skin. You do not want to put it in the disposal, or it could get clogged. And then you know what you'd need.
Joe the plumber.
And once a plumber comes to the house...
Orgy of spending.
Right on. But I digress. So, the raw cranberries, the small onion, plus 1/2 cup of sugar. And now the recipe starts to sound weird. 3/4 cup of sour cream. Finally, for the grand finale, the last ingredient, 2 tablespoons of horseradish.
It's a toxic mess.
Now, here's what you do. You ready?
Sit down. Talk. Talk. Talk.
Time now for action.
Darn right we
You
need.
Wash up the raw cranberries.
I don't care about an old washed up terrorist.
Not terrorist, cranberries. You grind the washed cranberries up with the onion. And then you add all the other ingredients, the sour cream, the sugar, and the horseradish.
Orgy of spending.
More an orgy of mixing. You mix everything up and you put the mixture in a plastic container and freeze it. Early on Thanksgiving morning, you move it down to the regular part of the refrigerator to let it thaw, like the polar ice cap.
I think it's clearly man-made.
By mealtime, you will be all set. The relish is chunky, creamy, tart, tangy, and Pepto-Bismol color. Everybody will love it, I promise. Although, sure, there are always a few detractors in the crowd.
I don't mind being attacked for the next 3 weeks.
Me either. I have developed a very thick skin about this recipe over the years. So, wishing everybody a happy Thanksgiving. I'm Susan Stamberg.
Miss Congeniality.
NPR News.
You betcha. Drill, baby, drill, and mine, baby, mine.
The full recipe for Mama Stamberg's cranberry relish, without the debate clips, sadly, is at NPR.org. A brand new ranking of the world's symphony orchestras hits the newsstands today, courtesy of the British publication Gramophone. At the number 1 spot is Amsterdam's Royal Concertgebouw Orchestra. The number 1 U.S. orchestra may come as a surprise to some, as NPR's Tom Heisinger reports.
Gramophone asked classical music critics from the U.S., Europe, and Asia to come up with their top 20 favorite orchestras. After the lists were compiled, the Chicago Symphony came out on top in the U.S. Gramophone editor James Invern says it beat out some tough competition.
Well, actually, this will be a surprise because a lot of people in America would, as a knee-jerk reaction, I suppose, would rank the New York Philharmonic at the top, or indeed the Boston Symphony Orchestra, which has fantastic technical standards. But Chicago beat a further 6 orchestras, which were in our top 20 from America.
Invern was inspired to conduct the poll because even though the level of playing is rising, he says there are fewer orchestras these days that have an immediately identifiable sound.
It's the equivalent, if you like, of having fewer great charismatic actors and many more kind of good-looking actors who are fine playing everything, but you don't take away their King Lear.
So, what's Chicago's unique identifiable sound?
Chicago famously has this incredible brass sound. And it just pins you to the back of your seat.
Mm-hmm.
The way that that brass sound shoots out exemplifies a lot about the orchestra, which is a sense of adventure in music making.
Not to sound too Chicago chauvinistic, but the rankings confirmed what those of us here in Chicago have felt for some time.
John Van Ryn is the classical music critic for the Chicago Tribune. He says not only is the 107-year-old Chicago Symphony in good health sonically, but also financially, something of a rarity for orchestras these days.
As of June 30th, the orchestra not only balanced its books, but turned up a modest surplus. They reported strong fundraising, ticket sales exceeding 85%, which is high for American orchestras.
While many American orchestras may be struggling financially, they are sounding good, at least according to Gramophone. 7 of the world's top 20 in the new ranking are U.S. orchestras. And for James Invern, that's good news. Much better, at least, than the din of backstage drama that sometimes rises above the sound of the music.
Some of the time it feels like what we're hearing above everything else about the American orchestral scene is all of the gossip and the intrigue and the backbiting and conductors being ousted and critics being shuffled around, all this kind of thing. But when all's said and done, you still make some fantastic music.
Tom Heisinger, NPR News.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep. U.S. intelligence analysts have been thinking about how the world might change by the year 2025. That's a little more than a decade and a half from now. And the forecast for what the world will look like is changing. Analysts believe the United States probably will not be the dominant world power. Countries will be fighting over food, water, energy, and other scarce resources. Terrorism will not disappear, according to the forecast, but it may hold less appeal for the young and restless. NPR's Tom Gelton reports.
The United States is getting a new president, and the National Intelligence Council has prepared a 100-page report for him and his administration on where the world will be headed as he takes office. According to Global Trends 2025, Barack Obama will preside over a country rapidly losing global power and influence. The last report of this kind was drawn up just 4 years ago, describing the world as it would be in 2020. At that time, the nation's intelligence agencies projected continued U.S. dominance. But that view has already changed. Thomas Finger, who chairs the National Intelligence Council, says it looks like the United States by 2025 will be just one of many global actors in a multipolar world.
Thinking of it as the rise of the rest rather than as the decline of the United States, and this is a good thing.
By 2025, China and India will be big economic players. Turkey, Indonesia, and Iran will be up and coming. World institutions, from the International Monetary Fund to the United Nations, will have lost influence, and the economic model prevailing since World War II, Western democratic capitalism, may no longer be favored. Instead, state-directed capitalism, like that practiced in Russia and China, could be ascendant. Thomas Finger says some countries that were recently convinced to follow the Western model, those in the former Soviet bloc, for example, have since become disillusioned.
Much of the world that sort of became democratic in the last 15 years has gone through more pain than gain. They've made adjustments away from populist regimes, away from socialist regimes, away from one-party dominated systems, and are still waiting for the payoff. The global financial situation is likely to exacerbate that. We have an alternative model, perhaps.
The intelligence analysts also call attention to major demographic factors that could contribute to global instability, especially in the Middle East, where Thomas Finger says there'll be a much bigger youth population.
That's a lot of raging hormones. That's a lot of young people with the normal, healthy disrespect for authority. In form of what their cohorts, perhaps in the big cities, across the border, across the sea, have that they don't have. This is a group that can be potentially mobilized for all kinds of things. Might be mobilized for very good things.
Or for bad things. The Global Trend Report says terrorism will continue to be a problem, with groups using more lethal methods and weaponry. On the other hand, the intelligence analysts predict that the appeal of al-Qaeda is likely to wane.
The killing of innocents, the killing of Muslims, the fact that it has no positive program. It's opposed to modernity. It's opposed to democracy. It's opposed to a lot of things that the youthful population clearly wants. So the environment will become less hospitable.
The world in 2025 is likely to be more complicated. Non-state actors, from multinational corporations to organized crime networks, will play more important roles. The analysts foresee at least one country, probably in Eastern Europe, turning into a criminal state. In Africa and South Asia, some states could actually wither away, undone by their failure to provide basic services to their people. One encouraging prediction, the world by 2025 could be well on its way to the adoption of clean, non-fossil fuels. The problem? Energy demand won't match supply, meaning the potential for geopolitical conflict over energy resources could be severe. Tom Gelton, NPR News.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Melissa Block. We've been having a lot of fun here, paging through a book that landed on our desks. It's called And You Shall Know Us by the Trail of Our Vinyl. It's a book of album covers showing the world of the Jewish LP. And that's Jewish in very broad strokes. It includes everything from the prolific cantor Saul Zinn to the Temptations Fiddler on the Roof medley.
If I were a rich man,
and let's not forget Yiddish humor. Here's Leo Fuchs doing the Yiddish twist.
We're gonna twist, 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 twist tonight.
And much more. The book is drawn from the collection of Jewish vinyl gathered by kindred spirits Josh Kuhn and Roger Bennett. They found each other and clues to their own Jewish identities as they pawed through stacks of albums. They pooled their collections, word got around, and soon, as Roger Bennett explains, their garages were overflowing with vinyl.
Boxes and boxes started to head our way. They were gratefully received. Each one was a crackingly good album, but it was more than that. It was like a footprint through history. And we started to become obsessed, and whereas normal men go to Vegas or go golfing or perhaps hunting, at the weekend, the two of us would head to the place where Jewish vinyl goes to die, which is, of course, Boca Raton, and spend hours cruising around thrift stores there and returning back laden down by vinyl.
The subtitle of your book, The Jewish Past, as told by the records we have loved and lost. Were you searching for something here, or was this something you just stumbled upon? Roger?
I think for me, it was more stumbling upon by chance. My mother, I grew up in Liverpool, which was an incredibly musical city. And she gave me, or I inherited, her record player. And with it came her records. And amongst the Mamas and the Papas' greatest hits and the Beatles albums were two that, even back then, I was 8 or 9, struck me as being fairly remarkable. One was an album by the great New Jersey singer Connie Francis, sings Jewish favorites. The best-selling Jewish album of all time, recorded by a Italian Catholic. And the second was an album which has come to loom large in my life because it connected me to Josh originally, which is Irving Fields' Bagels and Bongos, which is a Jewish guy who grew up in New York trying to make music that would please the Latin community.
Josh, what was it in particular about this album, Bagels and Bongos, that drew you to Roger?
Well, as you can probably tell, Roger's an incredible mambo dancer, so that record was a direct beeline to his heart and legs. For me, it was a record that was the key that opened up this whole world that I never knew existed, which was the Jewish Latin craze of the 1940s and 50s. And Bagels and Bongos was really just the tip of the iceberg. It's just beautiful, beautiful Latin versions of various Yiddish songs and Hebrew songs.
You show the cover of Bagels and Bongos, the cover of the LP in your book, and I have to say, there are bongos on the cover. There are no bagels.
Irving knew that, like the Abbey Road album, having a album cover that posed a lot of questions and made you think was not a bad marketing ploy.
Can we talk about the Barry Sisters?
Absolutely.
The Daughters of the Downbeat.
That's right. What should we talk about?
Well, this is Claire and Myrna, but not born Claire and Myrna. They were Clara and Minnie Bagelman from the Bronx.
That's right.
And you were kind enough to part with one of your LPs and send it to me. This is At Home with the Barry Sisters, and they're singing Yiddish songs, Hava Nagila, the classic repertoire. Mm-hmm. But you also have uncovered their album Our Way.
Right, from 1973, their last record. They're doing Yiddish versions of adult contemporary radio pop songs of the 70s.
Okay, we've got to hear Raindrops Keep Falling on My Head. Does either one of Please. You want to attempt it in Yiddish?
Roger, go for it.
They're about to tell it to us so beautifully, I don't want to rain on their parade.
Okay, here they come.
Tropfen's been raining off my cup. Pink via deckables is die kleine Farbein top. Geht mir kein Sach lind. Die Tropfen's been raining off my cup. Nor say Farben. Steh ihr hin.
Okay, you should know that right now our producer and editor and engineer are pretty much on the floor laughing. But it's a great song.
And what's so interesting about them is you mentioned that they were born Bagelman and became Barry, and they ended up changing their name because of the Andrew Sisters, that the Andrew Sisters had had a hit in English with the great Yiddish song by Meir Bistushain in English. And the Barry Sisters thought, now if these, you know, blonde Lutherans from Minnesota can have a hit with a Yiddish song, then certainly we got to be able to have a crack at this.
You know, we probably haven't paid proper due here to Jewish humor and humorous songs. I'm particularly partial to one that you sent me by Ruth Wallace called Bring the Boys to the House.
Oh, this is a little blue for NPR.
Well, it says right there on the cover, it says restricted from airplay, risque,
right.
I'll say.
We really believe in the power of only playing blue. And Ruth Wallace was part of this crew of body, trash-talking, hard-drinking, hard-smoking women comics in the 1960s who have really, for the most part, dropped out of history. I mean, Ruth Wallace has been remembered, but the women around her, like Belle Barth and Pearl Williams and Patsy Abbott, have been forgotten. A lot of the material is no longer available in any other format than LPs. Are we going to be able to hear a little Ruth Wallace?
Oh, please, let's.
Mama, she taught us to be smart with the men. How to do what and what to do when. There was Cuckoo and Gaga and me, I was next. We had one thing in common, we were all over sex. How you like my accent, darling?
I think this is a secret attack on Zsa Zsa Gabor. That's my theory.
And this was what year?
I'm guessing this has got to be the late 60s.
You know, when you think about what's become of this music, you pose this question in your book. What if the world actually sounded like this? What if Yiddish hadn't become the language of refrigerator magnets and Jewish joke punchlines? Have you come up with an answer to that? What if, Roger?
And honestly, we did the book as the beginning of a journey. I feel like we're only just taking initial steps to frame the questions that we've been talking through, even as we've pounded the streets, the tough streets of Boca Raton together, which is really, who are we? What are we inheriting? What does it mean to us? And what are we going to do about it? So that this book really is the beginning of a journey. The journey's not over, and we're framing questions. We've got thousands of albums left to collect before we can even think of answering them, Melissa.
Well, Roger Bennett and Josh Kuhn, it's been great talking with you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Melissa.
At our website, Roger and Josh talk about some of the performers they met as they researched their book, And You Shall Know Us by the Trail of Our Vinyl. At NPR.org, you can also find album covers and more music from their vast collection.
Dunkin' Bagel, Dunkin' Bagel, Dunkin' Bagel. Splash in the coffee.
How about a bowl of gefilte fish?
Cold? Hot?
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
If there are teenage girls in your life, you probably do not need to be told that there's a new movie coming to the big screen, Twilight, this weekend. You may know that it's about vampires. It's based on a blockbuster book series. And film critic Kenneth Turan says teenagers will totally love this movie.
I am not now, nor have I ever been, a 13-year-old girl. But Twilight made me wish I could be, at least for a couple of hours. It would help me appreciate a movie that has been targeted to that demographic with the specificity of a laser weapon. When Twilight opens, 17-year-old Bella is moving to tiny Forks, Washington, to live with her dad. Twilight's notion is that Edward is a sexy vampire, and Bella is very much alive. Placing this conflict in high school, where emotions are extreme and every moment is a crisis, was the masterstroke that created a phenomenon.
You know, your mood swings are kind of giving me whiplash.
I only said it'd be better if we weren't friends, not that I didn't want to be.
What does that mean?
It means if you were smart, you'd stay away from me.
Okay, well, let's say for argument's sake that I'm not smart.
I'd rather hear your theories.
I have considered radioactive spiders and kryptonite.
It's all superhero stuff, right? What if I'm not the hero? What if I'm the bad guy?
You're not.
Twilight treats high school emotions with unwavering, uncompromising seriousness. Laurence Olivier, attempting Shakespeare, didn't approach his material with more reverence. Even before the plot kicks in, Bella demonstrates the film's key attitude. As a teenager, she is, by definition, a deeply superior being, elevated far above the dross of everyday life. Forks High School holds no charms for this lofty creature, until she sees drop-dead handsome Edward. Aside from being a vampire, Edward is pretty much the ideal boyfriend. Though the story's action quotient has been increased to appeal to random males who might show up, Twilight is unabashedly a romance. All the story's inherent silliness aside, it is intent on conveying the magic of meeting that one special person you've been waiting for. Maybe it is possible to be 13 and female for a few hours, after all.
Kenneth Turan reviews movies for Morning Edition and the Los Angeles Times. And there is more on Twilight, including our interview with book author Stephanie Meyer at NPR.org. One of the people concerned about the bailout is Connecticut Senator Christopher Dodd, who sat down to talk with us yesterday. The bailout legislation passed through the Banking Committee, of which he's the chairman.
I've been disappointed that I didn't expect lenders to immediately start pouring money out the door. But when you get reports of hoarding, of paying dividends, of still having fighting executive compensation, excessive executive compensation, or acquiring healthy institutions for economic purposes, healthy banks acquiring healthy banks, that certainly was never the intent for the use of taxpayer money.
Well, wait a minute. Let me understand what you're saying. You're saying that $300 billion have been committed so far, and it looks to you like a lot of it is not being used to relieve the financial crisis. Banks are just doing other things with the money.
It isn't just the $300 billion, Steve, or the $700 billion, which we haven't committed all of that yet. Let me put it in perspective for you. It's about $5 trillion, Steve, we're talking about. If you take the guarantees, the increase in insurance and deposits, all of these things that have been done, the number is vastly in excess of $700 billion. I don't think I'm being excessive by demanding that these lending institutions show a commensurate degree of responsibility to the American taxpayer and to be taking steps to help us relieve the clogged up, seized up credit markets in this country. So if there's a note of anger in my voice, it's here.
Well, Senator, given that there was a big debate in Congress that was basically about attaching conditions, making sure the money was well spent, how did it happen that as soon as the bill was passed, it turned out that the Treasury Secretary, Henry Paulson, had, it seems, from an outsider's point of view, almost total flexibility in how he wanted to spend it, and once the banks get it, they seem to have total flexibility in how they want to use it?
Well, consider the alternative. 535 members of Congress have a lot of talent, but this is not one of them. And the idea that Congress would dictate exactly how this all ought to happen was not a great alternative, Steve. The idea was to get these resources to the Treasury, to the Federal Reserve. Obviously, they give them the latitude to move. But I want to use the opportunity of our conversation to express not only my frustration, but the frustration of my Senate colleagues here over the pace of this movement and the direction that some of these steps are taking.
Well, should banks hear a warning that if there is not some improvement in the next few weeks, you might be, say, at the very beginning of the next Congress writing in revisions to that to that law?
Absolutely, Stephen. Thank you for the question.
You think that you could be changing this and making it more strict?
We'd have to. I mean, I'm not left with any options. They know what they need to be doing. And they're not acting responsibly, in my view. And if they don't act responsibly, then I'm going to require them to act responsibly.
And do you believe there's bipartisan support for those changes?
Absolutely. And this frustration is not being expressed by a partisan group, my banking committee members, with whom I stay in very close touch and contact, I think are frustrated as well. And we haven't talked about foreclosure mitigation.
Mm-hmm.
Here was a condition we actually wrote in that I did with Sheila Bair, the head of the FDIC, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation,
mm-hmm.
to provide at least the option of providing a guarantee in the area of foreclosure mitigation. And I say this respectfully, but the Treasury's refusal to move on this is maybe the most frustrating piece of all, Stephen. And yet we're still dragging our feet on whether or not the government ought to be more aggressive.
Well, you mentioned Sheila Bair of the FDIC.
Right.
She's been on this program talking about her proposal to get into the mortgage situation and provide incentives for banks to renegotiate their mortgages. Henry Paulson, the Treasury Secretary, has said, I'm not sure that makes sense as a use of the $700 billion. As the law is written now, is that Paulson's decision? That's the end of it? He wins that argument.
Well, it is at this point, but and if we don't see some change in the next few weeks, we'll require it. My good friend Barney Frank has some indication that we may be seeing a change of heart in the Treasury on that point, but I don't know any more than I've just told you. But I'm hopeful that's the case, and if it is, then we may be hearing some good news coming out of Treasury shortly.
Barney Frank, of course, is your counterpart in the House.
Yeah.
Senator Dodd, I know this is a complicated situation, but I guess at some point you may have to narrow it down to a yes or no. Either yes, this is sort of working well enough, and despite our concerns, we'll go forward, or it's not working, and we need to start changing the law. If you had to make that decision today, where would you come down? It's working or it's not working?
It's working. It's working. That doesn't mean it's working to the point where in January, February, March, we're going to start to see a complete turnaround in the economy. No one's ever predicted that. But clearly, this is the right track. In the absence of doing what we did at the 1st of October with the Emergency Economic Stabilization Act, Stephen, this problem would be 1,000 times worse. We now have the tools to begin to make some choices. In the absence of that legislation, we'd literally be standing here twiddling our thumbs and watching an economy deteriorate.
Senator Chris Dodd, I appreciate you taking the time this morning.
Thank you, Steve.
We have transcribed our interview with Senator Dodd. You can read it at npr.org and also find more stories on the financial crisis.